and resources for parenting, but it's not cookie cutting. And the recipe is really interesting. And we've all baked up our own recipe, and we've been eating it. Is there anyone here, any couple here, or if you're representing your spouse, that do not have children? Okay, we've got two. Well, we're gonna excite you. Now, do you have husbands? Okay, wait until you have husbands. That's our advice. I grew up in New Mexico, and I grew up on a ranch. I didn't have a saddle for my horse until I was 11 years old, and I started riding a horse when I could really walk, about 3 years old. But there's a story that goes, two guys were headed out through the desert in Arizona, horseback, and they pulled off one night and camped and had their beans and cornbread going, and the fire was shining brightly, and all of a sudden it was kind of a shock. They heard some noise, and an old prospector with his mule pulled into the firelight. So they invited him in for supper, and he didn't say much, and you know, we don't say much in that part of the country. And so they talked a little bit, tried to get some information out of him, and he didn't say much. But they were all tired, so they were getting ready to put their head on their saddle and pull their saddle blankets over them and go to sleep. And he did say one thing. He said, "By the way, guys, where are you headed?" They told him. He said, "Well, tomorrow, probably about noon, you're going to hit kind of a dry creek bed. Take some time and pick up some stones. And afterward, you'll be both glad and sad." Pulled his hat down, pulled his saddle blanket up, went to sleep. Well, they thought about that a little bit, but they were tired, and they dropped off to sleep. They woke up bright and early the next morning. The stars were still out, and the sun was not up, and lo and behold, the old prospector was gone. With his mule, he had slipped out. They had slept so hard. So they cooked breakfast, saddled up, took off, hot ride down through the desert. They were trying to get to Sonora, Mexico, or someplace. And sure enough, about noon, you know, the sun was straight up. It was hot. They kind of dropped into this arroyo-type thing. And then they thought of what the old prospector said. But it was hot and down the bottom of this thing, and they picked up a few rocks and stones, you know, kind of pebbles, and put them in their saddlebags, and it was time to move on. So they rode all afternoon, rode into the early evening. They were really tired, completely forgot about what they had done around high noon. And so they were pulling their saddles off, and they thought, if one of them said, "Hey, you remember what the old prospector said? Pick up a few pebbles, and we'll be both glad and sad." I wonder what in the world the guy meant. Well, let's look into the saddlebags. So they took their saddlebags out, and as they poured them out, these rocks had turned into jewels and precious stones. And then they knew exactly what the old prospector meant. They were glad. Wow, were they glad that they picked up what they did. And then it hit them. Wow, they were sad that they didn't pick up more. And I think that's the way with raising children. I heard one guy said, he said this, he said he's never heard a guy on his deathbed say, "You know, I wish I'd spent more time working and in business and making more money." And so I just want to use this to set the tone. Our children, we have five. They're young people. And next week sometime, the clock will turn on one, and they will be 20, 22, 24, 26, and 28. And they're all single. And as we look back over their lives, boy, are we glad. Are we glad that we spent the time that we did? But I've got some sad ones also. I could have done more. So what we want to do, more than pass information on to you. You don't need more information. You can go get that. You're smarter than we are. Most of you got more time than we've got. But what we want to do is try to pass on to you and to use the appetite that you have and increase that. And so we're going to try to kind of move down through this in a creative way. But essentially, and I'll let you in on a little secret, we're going to come to the end, and being a salesman, and I'm going to do it, she's not. She's never helped me in my sales, really, and I didn't want her to. But I'm going to sell you. We're going to both try to sell you on what we know after 29 years of digging every place that we've been motivated to dig about raising children. We want to sell you on what God has put together that we have seen so far is the greatest. It's not the ultimate, but it's the greatest help that we have seen in our lives or that we have heard about from anybody that we know. And we know quite a few people around the earth. And we want to try to end up selling you on that. So what we want to do is just give a quick overview and on the types of parenting. And we all identify with these. And Barb, if you'll write them on the board. But really there are 10 types of parenting. And you can quickly write them down. We'll go through them. The first is permissive parenting. And we've all had a big dose of that. Oh, sure, you can have some candy. You want some more ice cream? I can remember the first time that a friend of mine who was trying to help us in our family brought up the deal that, you know, you don't give little Craigie all the ice cream he wants to eat. And I thought, well, why not? Just let him eat until his heart's content. I didn't know why. I mean, that sounded kind of restrictive to me. I grew up, I had three dads by the time I was 11. My real dad I never knew. One middle stepdad was not worth knowing. He tried to kill my mother three times when I was four or five years old. And then my last stepdad was a neat guy, but he died at age 32 when I was 11 years old. I had one little brother and my mother was 6 months pregnant. And we had a ranch and a new tractor and a new combine, farming about 900 acres and trying to run the ranch. So I grew up being able to do a lot of what I wanted to do. The first 4 years of my life during World War II, I was born in August 1 of 39. My grandparents raised me, so I was around uncles and aunts, and they thought I was hot peanut butter, you know, and I could do... You know, they wanted me, I was the little royal something. Okay, permissive parenting. The next is protective parenting.
Oh, don't do that, Joe, you know. Oh, I can't let him do that, you know.
Particularly you mothers, you know.
Oh, the bicycle, you know.
So us guys have to take them out, skin them up, and, you know, prepare them for life. But you'll be amazed. You can see this, how overprotective.
Oh, no.
Now, there is a degree, but I've always pushed on the outer limits and Barb on the inner limits, and we've made a pretty good balance. And we haven't scarred each other up too much on that one either. The other one is the bribing parent.
Johnny, if you'll just be good, I'll give you a candy bar while we're, you know, until we get out of the store.
So we bribe them, and you hear this, and we've all done it. The bribing parent. Then there's the threatening, repeating parent, and boy, have we done that one. Johnny, time to come. Come on, Johnny. Now, Johnny, it's time to come. Come on. Johnny. It's the last time I'm going to say this. I'm not going to say this again. Johnny, it's time to come. Howard Hendricks tells I'll tell the quick little story that Howard Hendricks told when he was a little boy playing, and he was out playing in the sandbox, and let's say the kid's name was Johnny, so the mother hollers out the door, Johnny, time to go home, you know. He just keeps playing. Well, two or three times, then pretty soon the voice changed. Johnny, come home! Johnny looks over at Howie and says, I've got to go now. So the threatening, repeating parent, the child knows exactly when the last one is what they really mean, and that's when they respond. Of course, the mom or the dad is exasperated by the time they do the fourth or fifth one. But anyway, the threatening, repeating parent. Now, the silent, delayed parent. You know, just don't do anything. Or just let it happen. We've got a phrase in our country, New Mexico, that all of the, at least the older parents, when they're kind of describing their kids, they say, well, Jack just grew up. You know, he just grew up. Well, that's kind of just let him go. You know, general guidelines. Keep him between the two fences and hope you don't hit some cows when you're driving. The absent substitute parent, and this could be either moms or dads, you know, always some project, always some work. I have an office right next to a dentist office. I've gotten to know this young gal. She works on my teeth, cleans my teeth. I don't brush my teeth anymore. She just cleans them every once in a while. But she became pregnant, and her and her husband, expecting their first one, has the baby, takes 3 weeks off, and she's back at work. She gets there at 7:30 in the morning. So I'm there, sitting there. I've got two big windows in my office. She drives up at 7:30, and I thought, I wonder what time she has to get up of a morning in order to get the baby ready, because the husband works, and get the baby over to wherever the baby goes, and then, you know, get to work and be at work on time at 7:30. And then she leaves at 4:30. So, the substitute, or the absent parent. The manipulating parent. We've all manipulated. And I tell you, for us guys, probably what we use is anger. Or, you know, the stern look. You know, but something to manipulate on the outside to try to get some behavior, to try to milk a little satisfactory behavior out of them. So we manipulate them. And we've all got, you know, a nice bag of manipulative tricks in order to do that. Then the unapproachable, discouraging parent. And boy, have I done my share of that. Embarrassed, sad case. You know, discouraging. Negative. You know, I have dressed my kids down, just skinned them. Angry, because I was kind of a threatening, repeating parent. So I finally got to the last one. I pulled out my buffalo skinning knife, and this is it, Doug. I'm going after you. So here I go, and it's all wrong. But I started way back threatening and repeating. Okay. The unapproachable, and can be unapproachable. Hey, don't talk to Dad. Boy, he's mad. Give her space. Once Mom gets riled up, whoo, rolling pin and et cetera, et cetera. So kids know to stay away, unapproachable. Wait till she cools off. Wait till she gets her feathers down. Her quills go down. So here we go. Child-centered parenting. Now these can kind of, you know, they all work into a beautiful mess. And we've all experienced it. So here comes the grace of God. The last one, and this is the target, is the biblically balanced parenting. And that's it. We'll kind of refer to these as we go along, and we're going to kind of go back and forth, mom and dad and so on here. I want to give you quickly the stages of child rearing. And, you know, psychology books have been filled with this years and years ago, no doubt. But it really helped us when we finally began to see and to understand there are some stages. So quickly, I'll give you the stages. The first one is the discipline stage. And it's about, you can say 0 to 5. You actually start before 1, so I wouldn't say 1 to 5. And this is where most of the discipline is going to come in. When this stage is done correctly, basically chastisement, which we use as a better word for spanking, is over by about 4, age 4 or 5, if there has been good, consistent, godly, correct discipline. You see anybody that's having to really crack down on their kids, when they're up in age, and here's what's happened. It ought to be like this. here is the parenting funnel. And the discipline stage is a funnel stage. But when you get into permissive parenting, it goes the other way. Oops. This way. Then where you get in and really build a dynamo for teenage rebellion is, hey, I've got to rein this kid in. So here they are, about 10 to 12 or 13 or 14, and try to rein the kid in. You can't do it. So discipline, 0 to 5. Okay, training is in the same period also. So during those years are training years. And that's basic training. You are aware of the level of crassness in our society, publicly. Folks, the F word is as common as post-toasties. You can hear it in football stadiums. Barb and I were at a high school football game a few years ago, and there were two high school girls sitting right over here, and they were using the F and the S and a few other words just freely back and forth with good emphasis. I had a cup of Coke, so I poured the Coke out and put the ice on my ears so it kind of, you know, sizzled them down a little bit. But crassness, where does this come from? Well, it comes from the opposite. Comes from training and discipline. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. A lot of people have problems with that. Barb came from a yes, sir, yes, ma'am family. I thought it was stupid. I thought it was, you know, kind of, gee. And I laughed at it for a while until I saw the effect that I was having, the counter effect on our children, not being gracious and didn't know how to relate to adults. So I changed my tune. But how many children in the training? Hey, mommy, 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 and you're talking to her. Mommy, daddy, how about this? You train your child, it can be very thin. They come up and they just lay their hand right there, and they stand there. And mommy knows that the first break, and the child knows, the first break she gets, she's going to look down and say, Lisa, what can I do for you? What a difference. And the difference is in a little discipline, is in consistent discipline and in training. But look at the kids. In fact, one of our couples, I was at Albertson's the other day and just kind of running up to the store, and the mother, they've been through 17 weeks with us in what I'm going to sell you on. And but it didn't take. And the little boy is about like this, and she had taken something from him. And that's about the time I came around the corner, and he was throwing a wall-eyed fit, jumping up and down as she was dispensing this thing in the garbage can. And then she saw me, and it was an embarrassing moment. They had applied nothing. And in fact, it's too bad they went through the course, because they haven't done anything. Now they're loaded with guilt. So it's better to not to know the truth if you're not going to do anything. I'd rather not know the truth and live a life of not guilt than trying to deal with the guilt. But anyway. Okay, discipline and training. Then we get in, and by the way, this was come up with Gary Ezzo on Genesis 1, that God, when he put creation together, did stage 1, because when he would go to do stage 2, it depended on stage 1 already being established. Then you can do stage 2. You miss discipline and you miss training, and then look, this is the third one, teaching from 6 to 12. Go talk to any school teacher. We have a school teacher friend. And I tell you what, we have two of them that we're very, very, very close to. And Ruth up in Colorado has to go back and do stage 1 and 2 before she can do stage 3. It's impossible to teach these kids without discipline and without them being trained. So she's got to go back to square one. She goes back to square one the first day. In 6 weeks, she has control of the class. Isn't that right? Doesn't it take her 6 weeks or less?
Well, it takes about 3 to 6 weeks to have it where they know what to expect.
Yeah.
But she has to use all that time for training.
Yeah. So discipline and training is a prerequisite to the third stage of teaching. Are you having trouble teaching? It's because I had trouble disciplining and I had trouble teaching. So, yeah, teaching gets a squeeze on. But these things work for us positively. I don't want to just throw us negatively. Okay, about 6 through 12, and that is the beautiful time. I tell you, 6 through 12, kids just think parents are the greatest. You can make horrible mistakes, which we did and I did, and they'll forgive you. But then becomes a new day. And this stage, about 13 through 18, has got to be coaching. Now, at the stage of teaching 6 through 12, you can actually stop the game. Stop the game. Pull them out, and you can teach. But when you start to get into teenagers, different game, isn't it? How many have teenagers? Or maybe beyond. Okay. It's now coaching. Friend, you're on the sideline. You step on the field, and you get called by an official. They're the official now. Right? They really are. They've got the whistle. And you're sitting over there, you know, all kinds of hand signals and so on, and they're playing the game. And where does this lead? And this is where Barb and I are. 18 plus. We have gone from a benevolent dictatorship, passed through the stages imperfectly. And you know what we've got left today? There's only one thing that we've got left today. It's influence. They come when they want to. They go when they want to. They make their decisions, good, bad, or indifferent. Hopefully, and we have a good bit of this, but we've got friendship, influence, and they'll come to us for counsel. But that's all we've got. Okay, those are the stages. But they really help. One other comment. No, I'll do it in another phase here. Okay. Ta-da-ta-ta. You're going to do the recipes.
Mm-hmm.
Here you go.
I can't recommend this book too highly. It's by Andrew Murray. It's called How to Raise Your Children for Christ. I call it the Divine Dictionary. And if you're familiar with Andrew Murray, he was a pastor back in the 1800s. He was born and raised basically in South Africa. He went to England and then to Holland for seminary. He went back to South Africa and lived to be 89. And he wrote this for young mothers and fathers who are raising their children. And as I was thinking about Jim White this morning, as he was sharing, much of what Jim shared was simple, but it was deep. And this is Andrew Murray's book. When you first read it, and particularly if you've had a Christian background, you'll think, I know this, I know that. And you just kind of swiftly go through it, not realizing that it has tremendous depth. What Jack and I did, we took a week on each chapter, read it out loud to one another, and got time together on where are we? And it was a tremendous, tremendous help. The reason I share that, I know many people, and I was one of them. I had it for years before I ever read it. And so I would encourage you to get the book. They have it here. I want to share a couple of things with you on the recipes. Number one, bring. In Matthew 19:14, Jesus said, "Let the little children come unto me, and forbid them not, for such is the kingdom of heaven." As it is our responsibility as parents to bring our children to Christ. And that's not just salvation, although that is tremendously, tremendously important, but we can't save our kids. Only the Lord can do that. But the child cannot bring himself to Jesus. And so you can do it because they have no power. But we can bring them through our example, through modeling, through stories, through music. We're talking about the small fry here. And make our home where Jesus is the center and our love for him. And many times what we do as parents is we're very concerned about this when they're little, and then they get saved. And then we just take a siesta or we go do something else. We think, I finished my job. And we forget that that's just the beginning and that That is when you teach and you train and you give them the reason. You go from precept, which is law, to principle, which is how this is lived out, and then you always attach it to the person of Jesus Christ. Josh McDowell is telling that all over the country, because what we have failed to do as parents is we don't link it to the person. For example, why be pure? Because God is pure. Why be truthful? Why can't I lie? Because everything's relative these days, is what they're taught. We tell the truth because Jesus is truth. And we begin to see the tremendous reason why we're doing all these things, and our kids need the link. Then the second thing is we're to feed them. And in John 21:15, this is really interesting. This is when Jesus was reinstating Peter. And in verse 15, when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." Have you ever thought your children are Jesus' lambs? They're not just ours, but they belong to Jesus and how precious they are to him. And we want them to be daily fed so they can grow up to be the sheep of his pasture. And isn't it also interesting, and I had not seen this connection, that the person to whom Jesus gave the responsibility was someone who loved him. That's why he asked Peter, "Do you love me?" And when Peter said yes, then the Lord said, "Feed my lambs," because they're so important. So our responsibility before the Lord is we've got to love him with all our heart, all our soul, and all our mind. Then we can feed our lambs. And we teach them the love of Jesus, that they will that we, as a parent, obey Jesus very carefully, we walk with him very closely, and we trust him very heartily. Teach them to pray. Teach them to talk to Jesus. Really make your whole atmosphere where Jesus is so approachable. And he doesn't remain the flannel-graft Jesus, but that he grows as they grow and they get to know him. Another verse that I like to share with that is Proverbs 12:27. The lazy man does not roast his game, but the diligent man prizes his possession. Another translation says, the lazy man does not roast his prey, that which he took in hunting. And if you can imagine, if you men are hunters in here, I know my husband's a hunter, and you go to all this trouble, you know, you get up at the crack of dawn while it's still dark as pitch, and you have all your equipment and your gun, and you're hunting for deer or something in New Mexico, and you go through all of that, get your deer, and then you never do anything with it. You just either let it rot or you don't, it never becomes what it should be, which is to be food. So the lazy person doesn't roast the game. He doesn't eat it. And that's when we fill our notebooks full of notes. That's when we go to conferences, but it never comes a part of us. And so the lazy man does not roast his prey, that which he took in hunting, but the diligent man prizes his possession. So we need to incorporate that. Then going on quickly, we're to teach them. Romans 2:24 is a wonderful challenge to us. Thou therefore which teachest another, don't you teach yourself? And we need to be learning, and one of the first things we need to learn is wise self-control. I don't know about you gals, but I have had great difficulty with that in some areas of just control. My tongue, of the way I've disciplined the children, I use shame, because that's the way I was raised. My dad could just make me feel so guilty and just shame me. Well, you know, blah, 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 you know, she thinks she knows best. And today I still feel that pain. And so I did not exercise wise self-control with my children. I used anger, I used shame, I used guilt, until the Lord showed me how destructive that was in our oldest. It took a while for him to pull out of that. And what he did with it was that he felt he could never please God, that he had to be perfect, that he couldn't approach God. And the Lord has graciously removed that image, but it was definitely there for a long time. We need to train our child to form habits of quiet thoughtfulness in how they speak and how they act. And for us as a parent, we need to be very careful that we don't give way to impulse and temper. And sometimes what we do, you know, you've heard of the straw that breaks the camel's back. Well, boy, that's me. You know, dinner's going and I've got this and I've got that, and one of them tracks mud across my kitchen floor and I just go boom. And I've just realized, you know, Lord, that was an impulse because I just gave in to what I was feeling. And so we need wise self-control. And that love must be the law of our life. No unkind words, no harsh judgments, no unloving reports are to be part of their conversation. And then I just want to sum up this part of mine, is that all teaching requires time, trouble, patience, and payment. Time, trouble, patience, and payment. And gals, I would especially encourage you to read what Hannah was able to do in the life of Samuel. I'm not sure how old Samuel was when he went to live with Eli, but she had accomplished five things in his life. And this is in 1 Samuel chapter 3. I wish we had time to develop it, but you see in chapter 3 that Samuel was obedient. Well, first, in verse 1, we see that he had responsibility. Teach your children responsibility. So in verse 1, he had responsibility. In verse 4, we see that he was obedient. In verse 6, we see that he was good-tempered. In verse 14, we see that he was humble-minded. And in verse 18, we see that he was brave and truthful. And as you read through there, you will see how she was able to inculcate that into Samuel's life.
Gary Ezel, who I'm going to introduce to you, said this: you can lose only one generation, and you've lost a culture. And if you could take the Christian parents in this country in the last, say, 25 years, just taking ours, if we had done a good job in building disciples, and in many cases that's true, can you imagine the impact and the effect upon our society? And I think the big failure, you're looking at it, fathers. And I want to give just a short one on fathers. This statistic is not quite right. I read it some time ago and I didn't quite capture it, but if there is a father in the home, 70-some percent of the children will come to Christ. Now, I'm probably lacking some details there if it's a Christian father and so on, but okay, a Christian father, 70%. If there is not a father, I think it's around 15% come to Christ. Tremendous, tremendous impact of fathers. And, you know, Jim was talking about ambition and what our society wraps us up in, particularly us men. We've got to get ready to make our contribution, our career, you know, and all of the stuff. And boy, I tell you, it's a beautifully laid trap. Beautifully laid trap. And the real side rail, in other words, to sidetrack an entire train, you've only got to pull one lever and just move the rail, a 10-foot section of rail over. And to me, it's the fathers. And the enemy has done it. And we've got to recoup that ourselves, and we've got to disciple other fathers to give the time and attention and the love and the teaching to their children, because fathers have a tremendous impact. They have more impact on a child than the mother has. The mother will do more teaching, but the image, impression, and the impact will be greater without father or with the father. I believe that'll true out. I want to direct you just to a couple of scriptures, and right quick, one in the Amplified. If you haven't read this in the Amplified, get it and write it out. This is just dynamite, and I'm going to read it. And this is Deuteronomy 6:6. And I tell you, when the change really began to occur in my life regarding my children is when this got into my heart. And I would say this really did not make its permanent impact in my life until I was in my early 30s, and Craig was already probably 4, 5, 6 years old. Now, I spent a lot of time with my kids, you know, playing and everything else. But I tell you, when this began to get into my heart, there was a real change. And Deuteronomy 6:6-7 in the Amplified, and I'll just read it to you. And of course, this was Moses saying, and quoting God, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. This is 5, your mind and your entire being. And then listen to this in 6. And these words which I am commanding you this day shall first be in your own minds and in your own hearts. Now, we have worked with approximately 100 couples in the last 4 years in this growing kid stuff. And I tell you, the biggest struggle is not the children, turning the children around. The biggest struggle is getting mom and dad turned around. So this has got to penetrate our hearts. Then listen what he says here. He says, it shall first be in your own minds and your hearts. Then, and listen to these words, you shall whet and sharpen them. It's like taking a knife, and it takes time on a whetstone to sharpen. Whet and sharpen them. How much time do you as a father give to training your children and to building quality and values and so on in their life? I didn't give near enough. Some of those, you know, I'm both glad and sad. Okay, whet them so as to make them penetrate. Boy, that word, penetrate. And teach and impress them diligently. Diligently. Upon their minds and hearts of your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. That's a tremendous passage right there. And I like the Amplified in those words. So what we want to move on to do, take your yellow page, Knowing Your Child, and I want to go through this briefly. Pardon? Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. It's pink. I thought that'd kind of soften us guys to have to work with a pink sheet, you know. Okay, I'm going to read this, and you guys underline this. The fact each stage of a child's life blossoms with new activities, insights, and possibilities. Then underline these words. The emotional, physical, mental, and spiritual, those four aspects of their lives constitute, encircle this word, a garden of potential. Circle garden. Our jobs as mom and dad is to circle this word, weed the garden. Circle, prepare the right amount of soil so that these flowers have, circle, full opportunity for growth. Then there are three in this next sentence here. Number one, developmental awareness is necessary. Put a one right by developmental. And this is why we began to kind of cook on the front burner when we began to get a perspective of what was going on and what a child could learn and do. And just kind of a disclaimer, I grew up, by the time I was 6 years old, in fact, I turned a big tractor over on top of me when I was 6 years old driving it down the road. The neighbor was honking behind instead of just passing me. He beep, beep, beep. And so I was driving this big tractor looking around, and it went off a 15-foot drop and turned right upside down, and we fell down and hit the bottom. And I was pinned under the seat and not hurt at all. And I think I was 6 years old, 6, 7 years old, not over that. So what did I do? You know, at age 11 and 12, I was working 15 hours a day in the combine season driving a tractor. I could drive a truck at age 11 and 12 and go under the spout of a combine. I ran into a guy's radiator one time that was combining for us, and he cussed me out and went over to my uncle and said, I'm going to have this kid, you know, tearing my combine up. He can't drive. But really, that's the only mistake I made. Of course, tore up his radiator. But see, I passed this on to my kids. My kids didn't grow up on a farm and a ranch. So I was totally unbalanced. And Barb kept telling me, you know, hey, you know, they can't do that. Well, I was tough and hard and brittle and demanding and everything. You know, good night. I didn't have the developmental awareness in the situation, so we need that. So that's number one. Number two, know what the plant needs. That's number two. And this is the stages. What do they need in discipline? And we're going to tell you just, there's one that Gary and Anne Marie Ezzo, this couple that we've hooked on to, does in toddlers that is unbelievable in discipline. I'm telling you, honestly, you cannot believe what can be done to an eight-month-old in the high chair in the playpen. Isn't that right, Barb?
A little older than that.
Yeah, I'm a little off, you know. But anyway, what the plant needs. And then, listen to this one. This is fantastic. Third, what combination brings growth? And as we all know, child raising is not one gear. It's like driving a diesel truck. You got to know what gear to get it into and how to gear it down and gear it up, and you don't go from gear one to gear five in a diesel. It'll kill it, kill the engine. So what combination brings growth? This awareness, and we'll go through this pretty quickly here, knowing what children are capable of at a particular age, and I was horrible on this. I began to sharpen and tune up some, but I was way off because I was coming out of my own perspective. Two, knowing what they need for healthy growth, emotional stability, intellectual development, and knowing specifically how to aid them in that growth. Let me give you five questions and just write them down on the bottom of that of the page that tremendously helped us, and we use them, and we've used them all these years. Number one, what do they need? This is the big picture. What do they need? So just start writing out. We'd go, and when our kids were growing up, we tried to take 3 days, three times a year, just to get off and do nothing. We did two things. One, rest, and then talk about our kids individually and pray. What do they need? And just start making a list. Well, what, you know, I see this and so on.
What you might want to
include sometime are the fruits of the Spirit.
Yes.
Do they need kindness right now? Are they bopping each other over the head? Do they need long-suffering? You know, just go through the list, and that'll give you some more ideas.
Galatians 5, 22 and 23. Okay, what do they need? What do they need now? Then here's a real clincher. I never thought of this one. What are they ready for? It's easy to know what they need. You know, you can come to that conclusion pretty quick. But then, what are they ready for? And that takes some bridge building, some preparation, some creativity on our part. What do they need now? What are they ready for? And then how do I get it going? How do I implement it? And then the last one is, how do I keep it going?
So that there, you don't breed an atmosphere of comparison. And one will be stronger than the other one in one aspect, one in the other. And that can really produce some interesting situations. Okay, the last one, having a good idea what concerns, problems, and questions a child would have growing up in this day and age, what specifically your child has now in his or her phase of life. And there's some great material out on this. Okay. On the back, guys, fathers,
This is a little test to analyze our habits and characteristics. An effective father has special skills. These questions represent some of the special skills that effective fathers have and so on. So I'm going to ask you to do this test on your own. Can I show a hand of commitment that you'll do the test? Now be honest, if you're not going to do it, don't raise your hand. I won't kick you out. I'll kick you later once I get out. Okay. Do you view your fathering as an occupation or a circumstance? Ask your children questions about their lives. Do you know, I for almost 20 years now, I've been around businessmen. I believe I can count on one hand, and I've been in many different situations, you know, on buses, driving, in conferences, you name it, you know, and sitting around drinking coffee and shooting the breeze and so on. I rarely hear some father who's even talking about his wife, let alone his children. Do you? Are you around fathers that are excited about their children and excited about their family? Very, very seldom.
This first question, is it a yes or no question, or is it occupation or circumstance?
How do you view your fathering, in other words? So you could just write it out.
Which is one thing, or is it circumstance, which is different?
Mm-hmm.
No, pick one or
yeah.
the other.
Yeah.
What's the right answer?
Well, what is yours? And if it's something different, just put that down. In other words, is that a primary, is fathering my children a primary conviction and so on with me? Oh, do we have time? Okay, let me read it. I think this is
okay.
This is 100 years ago, written 100 years ago, How to Raise Your Children for Christ by Andrew Murray. I'm going to quickly read it. And he's given these scriptures, Ephesians 6, 4, fathers, don't provoke your children to wrath. 3:21 of Colossians, father, well, it's the same thing. 1 Corinthians 13, 4 and 5, about love, doesn't seek her own. And then Titus 2, 4, teach the young women to love their children. So here's what he says, though, particularly about fathers. Let us mark first that fathers are here specially addressed. They are expected to take a part in the management of the children. There are many fathers who neglect this and seek to throw the work entirely on the mother. When returning home from the day's labor, they do not feel inclined to trouble themselves. The children are regarded more as a burden and a weariness than as a charge entrusted by the Lord to be met in a spirit of love and gladness. By the way, over the years, I have done this very, very consistently, not 100%, but when I come in the door, the first thing I do is go to all of the kids and just say hello. And if they're busy, it may be nothing but just coming in and a tap and say, hi, Janine, how you doing? Or I'll go in the other room, and Lisa's in her bedroom, and I'll just lay down on the bed, kick my shoes off, and maybe 2 or 3 minutes. But I try to touch and go in every time I come home of an evening. And touch my children, and of course kiss my wife and a few other things. Yeah. Okay. They're regarded as a burden and a weariness, and more than a charge entrusted by the Lord. God has joined to the meekness and gentleness of the mother the firmness and strength of the father. Now see, that's what needs to be joined: the gentleness and meekness of the mother with the firmness and the strength of the father. That needs to be joined together. It is each, as each takes his share of the work, becoming the helper of the other, that the divine blessing may be expected. And on this account, it is of such great importance that in addition to the daily united devotions of the family altar, there should be set times when father and mother join in reading, conversation, and prayer on the training of their children. A half an hour a week set apart for this purpose, if it were for only 1 year, would bring a rich reward. And he goes on. I don't take the time to read it, but isn't that good? I mean, that's tremendous. Barb and I take a walk every night, almost, except, you know, when too tired or something, but probably 4 nights out of the week at least, sometimes 5. It's a 2-mile walk, and we just lollygag along. And that's the time we spend just sometimes just walking for a while, but talking, asking questions, just breaking out in prayer. usually around our family in a few situations. Sometimes it's on our minds between us. But we do that. We shoot to do that every night about 10 o'clock, sometimes around 10:30, just to stay up. Okay. Where are we?
You're done. We have 2 minutes.
All right. Here's the sales pitch. We met Gary and Anne-Marie Ezzo, who live out in California, about 5 years ago. Out of their lives of raising their children, they have been discipling families very pointedly, probably for the last, 12 dozen years? But it's come out of their lives. I told Gary, I said, Gary, you are the Francis Schaeffer of the family. And what impressed us when we lived in Brazil, knowing virtually nothing, having a very shriveled perspective, we began to read Francis Schaeffer. And what I saw of Schaeffer, that he put it all together. It wasn't the last thing. There might have been a few other things, but he put it together. And that's what Gary Ezzo has done. And you can read books, and there are some great ones. This thing is fantastic. We have gone through this in a tape series, I think, 5 times with couples when our kids were teenagers. And we did it not too awful long ago. So Huggins does a great job. This is really the best that we have seen on teenagers. But what we like about Gary and Anne-Marie, out of their lives, they have put it together from zero up to, you know, through the teens. And there are video series which in here. We'd be glad to talk to you. But I tell you what, they are very humble, saying, hey, this is not the ultimate. It's not the last thing, but we're working on it. We're working just in the input. But it has helped and transformed the couples and their children. Maybe you could give just a little blurb, like at our church. We've got about another minute. Just on the little children, remember when you went into the nursery?
Oh, you moms are going to love this. In toddlers, you teach them how to do sign language, thirsty, thank you, more. And so we have to train the little kids, we have to train the people who are coming in to teach or to take care of the little kids the sign language. And so when you go in the room, you'll see all these little, they're called rugrats, you know, that just kind of sit around. And so first, would you all like a cookie? You know, well, this is please. So you have all these, you know. And then, do you want more? And so they learn, they cannot articulate it verbally, but they know what they want. And it takes a lot of frustration out of your parenting because they can tell you by sign language what they want. So it's very practical and help like that.
End up with another story. This is not New Mexico, so don't get scared. Gary Ezzo told us this story in Austin when we were at a leadership conference about 2 months ago. They've been running with a group of couples who have small children and just going through the training and the material. So these couples, and there must have been 8 or 9, something like that. They had about 20 kids between them. They decided to have a picnic, so they invited Gary and Anne-Marie. Now, Gary's about my age. He's 55 or so, and their 2 girls are grown. They have grandchildren. But so Gary said, oh, yeah, we'd like to go. Well, the idea evolved, and the couple said, let's go to Pier 51 or Pier 57. Well, it's a pretty nice restaurant. That's where, you know, the people of L.A. go and spend an afternoon. They want it quiet, seashore, you know, and so on. Gary thought, he thought to himself, said, wow, you know, this could be risky. 20 kids going into this place. But he said, okay, let's go. Well, another idea evolved between the couples. When they got there, they said, let's put our kids at one table and we'll set at the other so we can visit. Gary thought, oh my goodness, this is going to be interesting. So they did. Here's what happened for the next hour and a half. They had children as young as 3 years old, as old, I think, up to about 9 or 10. Gary said this, honest to goodness. He said there was not one argument that broke out. There was not one glass of water that was spilled. They visited quietly. Nobody got up from their chairs and ran over to Mommy and Daddy. during that time. They said please and thank you to the waitresses and the waiters. They meshumized that entire restaurant. The staff was coming out and looking. The manager came out and said, what is going on? The people were quitting their meals looking at this spectacle. And Gary ended it up and said this, and I think this is absolutely classic. He said, do you know what these people were looking at? They were looking at moral beauty. Moral beauty. Isn't that beautiful? Well, let's pray. Father, we thank you that into the lives of your children, and we're yours, you build the very highest, which is your heart, your life, your values, your desires, your hope, faith. And it's moral beauty because it's yours. Father, penetrate our hearts. We've got so much hope left with our children. We've got so much of the grace of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit. Just lift us up. Quiet our hearts. Purpose our hearts in these coming hours and days to be all to these children that you've invested, regardless of their age, to grow in skill, in knowledge, in godly knowledge. And with your help, we will be used to put onto this earth men and women of courage that know how to do battle, and that will be men and women that you can use and be fruitful through for their entire lifetime. Thank you for our time together. In your Son's name, amen.